black box under the hood that replaced the carburetor and the distributor and all those other things that made car engines run in a coordinated way. Everything that involves thinking about what's the right thing to do, whether we should spend money on this, how much money we should spend, called resource management, all occurs at this one-stop number. So if you want to know what your Medicaid card gets you, if you have a complaint about an adverse incident or someone who's kicked out of care inappropriately, or if you need to get hospitalized, it's all one phone number, and we distribute the thinking part internally, and that phone number is always open. And it's connected to 911, police dispatch, ambulance services, and so on. There's been a marked expansion in the mental health system's capacity to work with police, corrections, and the courts. I think it's new behavior for Multnomah County Sheriff to bother to compliment the county's mental health system, and both our retiring Sheriff Dan Noley and our new Sheriff Bernie Giusto have come out publicly saying that the mental health system pays for itself in terms of keeping people out of jail beds and, most importantly, from returning again and again to jail beds in the cycle. This is the end stage of the lack of a mental health system for people who suffer from mental disorders. One of the things we had to do in terms of reallocation, it wasn't just all about laying off therapists, we had to keep people out of the hospital. The county was in a spiral of increased hospitalization whereby every year that went by, the hospital rate was going up 30%. To the extent that we were hospitalizing three times the number of people from Multnomah County were in hospital beds in the year 2000 than were in 1997. And we have that rate all the way back down now to where it was in 97, 98. Only part of that was due to the disenrollment in March 1st, of course, since we're just seeing the effect of that disenrollment in another drop in hospitalization. But this was critical because right after I got my job, the price of a hospital bed day went from $430 to $700 a night. So we had to turn that around. And the problem is you can't just do managed care and say you only get three nights or something like that, because the way the law works, the hospital can hospitalize whomever they want, and we have to pay if the person needed the hospitalization, which is good. But it does mean to lower the hospitalization rate, you're not just kicking people out of the street and then putting them under bridges. That has not occurred. We have not seen a transfer, a cost shift into the jail system. Or believe me, we wouldn't be hearing from the sheriff the way we are. We put a huge amount of effort into improving relationships with underserved communities. We're doing an abysmal job before. We're doing an inadequate job now. And yet, that inadequate job is better than the abysmal job that we were doing. It turns out that many ethnic and language majority communities, especially most recently immigrated, the stigma about mental disorders and getting mental health treatment, if we take, for example, the Russian community in Portland, which is growing rapidly, it's almost, I was told by a cab driver, it's an insult to say that you're depressed. It's the same thing as saying you're ugly and you smell bad or something like that. You just don't talk about your mental disorder and what your psychiatrist said the way you do at cocktail parties in New York or Los Angeles or Boston, where I grew up, where everyone talks about what their therapist told them. These communities aren't into that. And so it requires a whole lot of outreach, in-reach, hiring, training of bicultural staff, and so on. It's not just about going to an encounter group. Actually turning over control of dollars to, in the Russian community's case, the church community. And so we're not going to be doing community mental health care in mental health centers anytime in this generation. We're going to be doing it in church basements. Let me talk about the next biennium. The budget crisis is, of course, going to continue, and I'm confident, I'm not really here to talk too much about what happens to what's left of the Oregon Health Plan or Medicaid services, because I'm confident that whatever the size of that plan becomes, it will be adequate for the people for whom it is designed, because the feds won't have it any other way. What concerns me much more, and I will talk a little bit about prescription drugs and so on later, is what happens to all the people who aren't part of the Oregon Health Plan, that is, who are not insured. And that's, we've seen this happen in other places. Los Angeles County in particular has, I think I heard, 2.1 million uninsured people in its population of 10 million. That would be the third largest county in America, just the uninsured in Los Angeles County. And it's a huge issue, obviously, for people who don't have CalMed and who therefore only get this. And it's such a huge issue that the newly elected sheriff actually created a brochure to advertise a tent city that's surrounded by a fence with security as a cure for the homeless mentally ill problem in Los Angeles, where you can live in a yurt. Here's your little cot in a tent surrounded by an attractive hedge built in an industrial area. And they say it's because it's the right thing to do, but it actually isn't. Treatment really does work. Treatment's really the right thing to do, and that's what I'm going to be talking about a little bit later, is what works.
Thank you.
So all of the counties now are going to be presented with creating a sort of safety net under and around the Oregon Health Plan, because no county will be able to avoid the consequences in to communities and criminal justice system of not taking care of the folks who have been disenrolled or who only get a kind of benefit that's almost impossible to access. At this point, I'd like to talk about the cheapest way to do the model, and essentially involves a great deal of treatment readiness and aftercare services. Treatment readiness services have been pioneered by the addiction systems, and aftercare services have been pioneered, that is, were sort of invented and brought to maturity by services with people with other kinds of disabilities, for example, neurologic industry or developmental disabilities.
Dr. Davidson, would you grab the microphone right next to you there?
I'm not sure if I can talk and write at the same time.
Okay. Well, to the extent that you need to.
Traditional, I'm just getting over a cold, so my voice is. Traditional managed care, essentially, and most of the things you'll see in your cost containment things that come out of DHS are about this. It's about...
Dr. Davidson, I hate to do this to you, but could you stand on the other side so the senator could focus on
this
side?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Different audience.
Ironed,
yeah. Traditional managed care companies really orient themselves towards decreasing the length of time in treatment. So if this is time where you're sick over here and well over here, you used to get 8 sessions and now you get 6 sessions. Or they used to pay you $80 and now they pay you $60. Or you used to get a wheelchair benefit and now you don't. So they try to save money by squeezing the benefit package. Well, for the best way, and if this had worked, Magellan would not be out of business. Magellan is the by far the largest managed care company in public sector mental health. They've been bankrupt for a long time. They finally filed the week before last. I've heard they're carrying $1.5 billion in debt now. And that's because this is the only thing they could think of to save money in public mental health care management. So, and they talk about it all the time, is trying to make therapy get shorter. The truth is, our folks don't really respond or don't really have these kinds of episodic disorders like you and I might have, where you come in and say, "Doctor, I think I have psychosis. It's come and gone for a while, and I'm wondering if you have a treatment for it." And it sounds facetious or flippant to say that, but so many of the way our benefit packages are designed and still thought of by, for example, OMAP policy analysts and so on, are as if the commercial medical model had something to contribute to cost containment. And of course, since World War II, healthcare costs have gone up like this. There was a brief period that went like that in the 80s when managed care started, but that was mostly the companies financing to gain market share. Managed care really hasn't decreased costs or improved quality. I would challenge anyone to demonstrate where that has occurred in public mental health. So let's think outside the commercial managed care box. Oh, the other thing I wanted to mention about managed care is if you lose your job, you lose your coverage. So obviously, if the treatment doesn't work and you lose your job, you're not really on the Blue Cross package anymore. And so they don't really have to worry too much about these anything other than the kinds of episodic care and whether six sessions can be substituted for nine. The way real mental health disorders work, both for families and for adults with chronic mental illness, is that not accessing and working with the mental health system is always the final common pathway towards a cash hemorrhage. It's called non-compliance in people's charts. And I see it. I've seen it for years. For the 15 years I've been doing this, you see, person comes in, gets their diagnosis, gets some medication, then they no-show, and then they no-show again. They're diagnosed with non-compliance, and then they're hospitalized or dead. And no one really does too much about it because you depend on them to show back up for their appointment if they really want care. And if it doesn't happen, it's just like someone else's problem. So in fact, you have to make contact with people and teach them how to access care and how to understand what mental health care is about. This is hugely about cultural competency, and by that I don't just mean ethnic and language minority folks. It's about everybody understanding that getting mental health care isn't just about getting a diagnosis and taking Prozac. So a whole bunch of this is a teaching and motivational interviewing process. And by motivational interviewing, I don't just mean pep talks. It's a whole sort of project now that has research and books are being written about it. And it's about, mostly it's about making contact with people so that they trust you and they can bring you to the beginning of the treatment interface. The whole point of this isn't to feel good about mental health care. It's about making this, the expensive part, real cheap, fast, and effective. Because when someone does show up and say, I'm ready to take medication now, it's amazing how well our treatment works and how little time you can spend in this expensive part. And in other words, we're doing this. This is why our hospitalization rate got cut in half. It's not because we shortened people's access to medications. It's not because we turned their treatment sessions down to one a month instead of two a month. It's because we figure out how to get people to really use the mental health system. So this is about getting them to use this. The treatment session is when they choose to use us. As it turns out, we can't force anyone to get better. We can't force mental health on people. And then there's this thing called aftercare. And we don't do a whole lot of this. Hasn't really happened yet. But we have to, because this is what keeps people from cycling endlessly through the treatment system. One thing that's very important to remember about community mental health is that it's brand new and the science is poor. These programs started in the late 70s, so they're at most 30 years old, and they were built to grow, and that's what they've done ever since. They grew and grew and grew because you'd grow your caseload, the money would follow, and you'd build another center, add staff, computerize, whatever. But the case, it wasn't an idea that you had to get better or leave the system, and there was a sort of patronizing thing that this, some of these folks can never leave. No, but the truth is, with a fixed budget, you have to have the rate going out the back door equal the rate coming in the front door, or you will bust the budget. If you can't just keep growing and growing and growing the system, and we can't, you have to have people who actually get better, which means that they have a life, a job, friends, they depend on each other instead of the crisis line, and they have meaning. They have something to do other than wonder what the, you know, who's not done something for them lately. Now, obviously, I'm not so naive to think that everybody can leave the mental health system and get a job and live happily ever after. But the truth is, this does have to happen. You have to have people leaving the same rate that they're coming in, because otherwise you guys are going to be hooked to constantly increasing the mental health budget. So how do you get people from recycling endlessly into the treatment system? Well, in neurologic industry, there's the Christopher Reeve example that everyone's familiar with. The treatment didn't work, just like with some chronic mental illnesses. He's still quadriplegic, but he sure is okay, and he's not in the hospital the way he would have been 15 years ago, and he has meaning in life, and he's got friends, got something to do, and it's because of occupational therapy, recreational therapy, which is not how to play, by the way, and physical therapy. These things didn't used to exist in the sophisticated form that they do now. And we have increasingly sophisticated methods of getting people into work and keeping them at work and into housing and keeping them in housing and taking care of each other and something more sophisticated than 12-step. That allows for recovery to get into some of the more complex and interesting aspects of life. So these are the... This is basically what works, and since it works, it's cheaper in the end. Keeping people out of the hospital by getting them better saves all the money that I've ever saved in my work as a mental health administrator over the years. And we've saved a lot of money in the Gobi and JBH regions. I think they hospitalize at a rate, it's been a while, maybe 1/6 at the rate of when it was just an entitlement. And I don't think anyone would say that it's because we cost-shifted into the sheriff's department. It is all about maintaining folks in the community. So this is the basic model that we're going to be constructing our safety net around. And how you fund this and how it's orchestrated depends on the local community, because some communities have tons of ancillary resources and some are relatively bereft. The less stuff that exists already in the community, the more you have to build. But mostly it's a matter of figuring out what's already there and making contact with what's there and gaining their respect and trust and that sort of thing.
Peter, question.
Yes.
Where does the call center fit into that model?
These are intelligent interfaces. That is, that these aren't just... The current way you get into the mental health system is you wander into it somewhere, somehow. You might end up banging down the door in the DD system for a while until someone finally figures out you really need mental health care, that sort of thing. So when I say an intelligent interface, I mean you have to have that thinking 24/7 distributor of who belongs where and how much money to associate with their transitions. And so we built a kind of... a system that has various sort of pods or domains around it. And this looks like 1968. And this is the call center. And in it, there are acute care coordinators, children's system of care coordinators. There's a bunch of people with lots of professional experience and degrees and connectedness. Remember, I was talking about connectedness all the time with various other systems. I knew it's going to break someone's neck. These are Department of Community Justice. Let's say this is the kids system. This is the Oregon Youth Authority. This is the primary provider's case manager, or the primary provider system. These are residential programs. This is hospital, and you can draw a lot of petals on these flowers. But somebody has child welfare, that does the temporary housing placement when the child is again found beaten and blah, blah, blah. You have to work all of these interfaces. And the old method of doing system of care work was you'd realize the child had multi-systemic involvement, and you would convene a meeting 4 or 6 weeks from now when one person from each of these things could all get together on their, the Palm Pilots out and have a meeting. They would wring their hands. Many of them would say, we've done all we can do, hope that somebody else in the rest of the system would pick up. But no one really owns the case. These call center people own the case. And it's not their job to force somebody else to do their job, but it's definitely their job to do more than just have a meeting and send memos and pay for another assessment. When I was doing consulting work, I would get basically the reason they would give them to me is they were cash hemorrhage clients. Some of them would have cost $60,000 in the last 4 months. What are we going to do? They would call me, and I would get this thick sheaf of paper, and it's almost all assessments, hospital assessments, specialist second opinions, on and on. Where's the treatment, right? You don't see a whole lot because nobody's owning the client. So a key part of getting provider system ownership is getting the right kinds of contracts so you can't dump someone out the back door and have no one notice. But it's also very important to have this 24/7 system that has the person on the screen with their family members and people they're connected to, associated with them, and the community-wide crisis plan, you know, what they're entitled to, who their payer is, that kind of stuff. And also this call center has money. It's backed by a variety of flex funds.
I'd like to ask you a couple of questions. First, I was intrigued with your analogy of Christopher Reeves and your statement that he's functioning fine in society. You suppose if he had been an unemployed handyman that had fallen and become quadriplegic, he'd be now functioning well in Multnomah County society?
Probably not. I guess it isn't the fact that he was Superman that has allowed him to recover from quadriplegia, because there are lots of people who have quadriplegia and spinal cord injuries who weren't Superman. But then to say that it works for everybody, that is to say, if he were an unemployed, low IQ, you know, drug addict, that would he be doing just as well, isn't the case. So what I'm saying is
that he's a multimillionaire in his own right, and he can afford to spend $2 or $3 million a year in his own care.
It doesn't give his life meaning. And there's plenty of evidence for that. Is to have meaning in life, you have to actually do something that supplies meaning. And the point was, he's doing something completely different than he used to be doing, and that's what has to happen with schizophrenia. When you come through it and out the other side, it's very unlikely that you're going to return in the way that the guy in The Beautiful Mind did to doing exactly what you were good at before.
Finally, follow-up, sir?
Of course.
Well, let's talk about the schizophrenic going. I happen to know a couple of schizophrenics who live in Multnomah County and are part of your process, and it's not been my observation that they flow rationally through an integrated, organized system and show up functioning, however you define functioning, at the other end of the system. Is that your argument, that that's basically the way your population of adult schizophrenics interact in the Multnomah County mental health system?
No, not at all. This would be like representing the proper way that we would treat leukemia as compared with a terrible way to treat leukemia. But then to say that it works for everybody would be false. The fact that it works better for a lot more people is inarguable. The fact that we started 11 months ago is also true, and the way the system looks 3 years from now is going to be qualitatively better than it is now.
And do you have a model where, I mean, you're saying you just started this. Are there some places we could go as a committee and go to Des Moines or?
You know, people ask me that all the time, and unfortunately the answer is no. There are all kinds of wonderful projects in and around, for example, L.A. County, which has one of the worst mental health systems I've ever seen. They also have one of the finest examples of this model that I've ever seen, called The Village. But it's only for a couple hundred people. It's not for the entire population of Los Angeles County. So it's important to remember that the community mental health movement started in association with deinstitutionalization in the late 70s, and in our case, in many places, in the mid-80s. And so this is a brand new thing in the world, and that is to do something that works for people with chronic mental disorders. Because even when I was in my residency, moonlighting up at Western State Hospital near Olympia, we would take 30, sometimes 60 admissions a night. So you just write a two-doctor hold, put them in a police car, and send them the way you all used to Wilsonville, and that was mental health care. So the whole idea that people can get better is heavily dependent on the revolutions that have been made in psychoactive medication in the last few years. Because when I was in my residency, you had Thorazine, you had Alavil, those, and then Haldol and Stelazine, all of which are just plain poisonous. And now you can take medications that work for the symptoms of schizophrenia and bipolar disorder that allow you to still, you know, not have the Thorazine shuffle and to think for yourself and have friends and all kinds of stuff that aren't possible when you're taking therapeutic doses of Haldol and Thorazine.
If I just may ask one more question. Of all the people who you would consider eligible or your responsibility in Multnomah County Mental Health, what proportion of them would you say are integrated into a rational, semi-rational system like you're proposing?
Maybe, well, of all the people who are eligible, less than half of them really need this model. That is, of all the people with schizophrenia, we know a lot of people with schizophrenia who we don't know have it. The people who we see wandering around on the bus mall and who don't do well often have some kind of compounding problem, such as personality disorder, low IQ, an addiction, very low socioeconomic status, and poor life skills. Sometimes they have none of those, but their illness, or schizophrenia in this case, is so severe that the chance that they're ever going to work again or live independently is almost nil. And so it's a very heterogeneous illness. And so to talk in just raw proportions, but let's put it this way. What percentage of the people who need this are getting it? Small percentage. Our system is still pretty bad. That is to say, if I had a person with a mental disorder and they lived in as a relative and they lived in Multnomah County, I would probably be spending a lot of time trying to make sure that they got this. That this is not automatic. This call center just went to 365 days a year, 24 hours a day, 2 months ago. So it's brand new. And even so, we aren't using the hospital as a residential program anymore. In other words, and we're not killing people. Our death rate is much lower than it was in previous years. It's still, we had 50 deaths in our caseload of 12,000 from non-natural causes last year. And when I got there, in one clinic that only had 500 open cases, I found 20 non-natural causes deaths in the previous year, in year 2000. So it's better, but I make no claims that it's, you know, that people should come visit us to see what proper mental health systems look like. I hope that someday in my career that will happen to a system I'm involved with.
Thank you, Chair.
Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you started your testimony, you referred to a program in L.A., the Homeless Public Safety Center, at this series of yurts, if you will, where people could stay, intended to be a clean, safe, inexpensive housing park. Housing, how does, and I think you kind of dismissed it as, well, that's not the answer, but housing is an element of stability in mental illness. How does housing fit in to your model, and affordable housing being in crisis as it is already?
Housing is hugely important, and how to live in housing, in real housing, is the key to the problem. It's not the lack of units in most places, and it's not even our inability in the city of Portland in particular, which is very tuned to this issue. It's not the lack of place or the lack of subsidized housing. In most cases, it's the lack of the people's ability to actually stay in the housing, that is, to not get evicted. And that's what's wrong with the model I presented in that brochure, is that it doesn't teach anybody anything to live in a yurt about how to get back into life. And so if you just put them in a camp and they never learn how to reintegrate with society, you're going to be building a lot of camps. So I think it's very important to treat people in the community and to take the money that it would cost to build a big camp with a fence around it, 24-hour security and so on, to do this model in the communities in which people actually wish to live.
I can pursue that for a minute, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Often, though, let's say somebody has a Section 8 certificate to live in an apartment, having a certificate to live in an apartment doesn't teach you anything about how to reenter society either. You may just be isolated in your apartment. And so let me kind of throw that piece out there and also throw out the piece that there is a shortage in Section 8 certificates or affordable housing. And when people are mentally ill, they often don't have an income that allows them to access non-subsidized housing. So isn't the availability of housing still part of the puzzle?
There is a bricks and mortar problem, but nothing is as expensive as the constant eviction, the cycle of evictions that occurs with our multiply diagnosed, not outlier, but average Medicaid client. That is to say, if they start taking medication that they and feeling better and deciding they want to stay in housing, we have an amazingly successful, it just sooner or later they'll get the place and they will stay in it, and then they will go out the right side of that chart. And but going out there, so if the camp that was depicted in the brochure is actually a transition into a natural system of support, by which I mean people, our people, in order to be better, need to be interacting with someone who is not paid to care. The more we pay someone to care, the less well they are. I mean, in general, health care. If you need surgery once a week, you're not as well off as if you need surgery once or twice in a lifetime. And so the more you're interacting with people who want to interact with you, the better off you are. And most of the skills that we find, whether it's in a youth residential program or an adult program like that, if you're surrounded by people who aren't functional, you don't learn life skills. You don't learn to respect authority, and you don't learn how to be patient, stand in line, and that kind of stuff. And so that's the problem with these concentration type of approaches. And the new methods really are about getting our folks living in real society. And so it is true. It isn't true that there's all kinds of empty Section 8 housing ready for people who are ready to go. But it is also true that to get people out of this cycle, they have to be in, they have to learn the skills to interact with people and be sober and have a job and that sort of thing. And we can't do that to them when they're in a hospital or when they're in a residential program or when they're in a camp.
Thanks.
Any other questions at this juncture? Please continue if you've got anything else here.
Oh, yeah. I want to talk a little bit about the KIDS system, because while its funding isn't threatened the way the adult system funding has been in the last few months, it's important to talk about changes there as well. In the past, we have had a dynamic that follows the revenue, that is, that when dollars are associated with children, we call it the KIDS system. And when the dollars are associated with adults, they go to the adult system. Well, that's not good for kids, is to have the care of the adults in their natural system support separate, in a separate business model, in a separate provider across town or whatever. So there's the child's therapist and then the parent's therapist and so on. There's this new thing called system of care thinking. And it basically is old in the sense that it borrows from theories that were developed in the 60s and 70s called family systems theory. And it says the children basically are healthy people are all suspended in a web, natural system supports. And if a child isn't, then you need to build one, because kids need love in order to behave. It's all pretty obvious. Plenty of research to support that. And so when I show up at a children's mental health center at the end of the day, and there's a line of vouchered cabs around the block, like at the Benson Hotel on Saturday night, you know there's a problem, because those kids are in individual treatment with other kids just like them all day at this sort of drop-off center, and that's not helping them be mentally healthy for the, you know, other 23 hours or 20 hours of the day when they are with the system that produced them. And, of course, this doesn't apply for autism and things like that. But we need to work with whole families, and we need to develop natural systems of support around kids.
Sorry, sir.
Mm-hmm.
Could you follow that cab business for me a little bit? What's the problem with having a cab?
Because you can't treat children as individuals, essentially. And so for them to be cabbing it back from school in a cab over to their therapy and then back to the foster home is not a good idea, because they don't get better with an hour or two of therapy a day or a week. They get better when they're suspended in a natural system of support and are attached to it. And that natural system of support has to be healthy, or there's no amount of treatment that will cause the child to become healthy in spite of their system.
It isn't true that some of the most successful day treatment programs, like the one designed 20 years ago at OHSU and other in the day treatment programs we're using for adolescents or for even young children, use taxis as transport to and from their homes as a part of the system?
Let's put it this way. If the child has a highly functioning natural system of support, there's nothing in particular wrong with vouchering a cab. You know what I mean? But the key is that that natural system support is functioning properly, and if that's not the case, and in many, if not most of our kids' cases, it isn't, then sending the child to treatment costs us a huge amount of money and doesn't have a yield. Hmm. So, and
thank you.
That's a fact. Okay. Would that they were true. I would love it if you could just take a kid and treat him and fix him without having to worry about the state of health of the place where they spend most of their time.
Well, I mean, again, but kids live in dysfunctional environments. I mean,
right.
They live in single family, even if they have one parent, they live in houses where their parents are need substance abuse treatment, and you don't have the money to provide it for them. I mean, they live in that environment, so I'm
right. And
I
the
agree.
Outcomes,
I wish
the
everybody
outcomes
lived
are,
in a television family, but
the outcomes
they don't.
Are terrible for kids who do live in. The resilience research is really in the kids who make it, who grew up in dysfunctional systems, if you will, almost always have somebody who is highly functional that they attach to. It could be somebody down the hall, could have been a grandmother. Could have been someone, but if they're not attached to anybody healthy, they don't make it out of dysfunctional environments, no matter what treatment is.
So we don't need to provide treatment for them? Is that
no?
That would save money if we defined it that way.
We need to treat the system as a whole, not the individual child. That's what the research is showing. You can't make up for the lack of love in a home or in stable attachment in a home with therapy. Therapy is not a substitute for stable attachment. Nor is medication, nor is hospitalization. So if you can't do something about who cares about the child and who the child cares about, you can't do much for the child. And
which I don't think I heard Mr. Davidson say, you shouldn't try.
No, but you need to try to work with who the child loves and who loves the child, not just how did it feel to be unloved and today. Type of stuff, which is the individual therapy they do in a sandbox or the Jungian style that I was taught in my residency. So it's all about relatedness. And
well,
you can't work on the relatedness without working with who the child is supposed to be relating to.
The issue we can talk about psychodynamic and psychotherapeutic theories here, but the question is, how do we build a community mental health system without regard to what our psychological, theoretical approaches. And while I wouldn't necessarily disagree with you, the question is, what does that say about the fact that we have a mental health system in crisis, and we have families in crisis, and we have a society in crisis, and what we're trying to do is to figure out how to create a marginally successful community mental health system without regard to the fact that lots of kids live in horribly dysfunctional families and are going to continue to live in them, and lots of adults who are the parents of those kids are also in your system.
That's exactly my point, is that instead of having a kid system and an adult system, we're going to have a different kind of bifurcation in our mental health system of the future. Sooner or later, we're going to have a safety net system that's associated with imminent danger to self and others, and people coming out of jail with mental disorders and bracelets on and all that kind of stuff, you know, civil commitment, in and out of hospital, institutional transitions, and the system of care for families. What we currently have is an adult mental health system and a kid's mental health system. What we need is a safety net mental health system that's associated with housing support, keeping people out of jail, that sort of thing, and a system of care for families' mental health system where you can't just look at a child and say, well, I'm the child's therapist. And I ask the therapist, as I've done all throughout my career, does this child have any friends? And the therapist says, I don't know. That's not an okay answer. It has to be more than just opening up to your therapist. That's not treatment. It has to be all about what they do when they go home in that cab. And, of course, these aren't rigid distinctions. I point out my little notes here. We have lots of these level one adults, danger to self and others, who have kids. And there are lots of level one kids who have no adults and probably never will. Because their autism and disabilities and so on are so severe that they will be dependent on people who are paid to care for the rest of their life. And that's just a bell curve fact these aren't rigid categorical boundaries. But I'm always talking about the average person with the average prognosis. Let me talk a little bit about who's in charge and the politics and how funding is controlled. I think it's pretty clear that mental health and addiction system funding needs to be controlled by the communities who need to figure out how to use it. That a statewide mental health benefit administered by, you know, the pharmacy benefit administered by a company in Ohio and the mental health part by Magellan and so on, hasn't saved money or improved access anywhere. We've been trying that for 25 years nationwide. I don't know of any system that is known to be the right model. I do believe that local control, because of the nature of this model that I've discussed and how embedded it is within neighborhoods and communities and families, the money has to be able to be brought to the community level, and that involves local knowledge. And almost more importantly, a commitment to the local community, which large commercial companies have not shown they have. In other words, when the margin doesn't make it, they exit the plan. And then they'll come back next year if you put more money in it, and then they'll leave the year after if that isn't enough for their, you know, underwriters to say we're going to turn a profit. So I'm a big fan of local community mental health centers that actually employ the people who do the mental health care as being a key player in any cost-saving effort in the future. Now, you can put them out of business. That's what Multnomah County was doing a whole lot of in the last few years, putting the nonprofits out of business, but that doesn't save them any money, as their hospitalization rate demonstrated. I do think that there are too many layers in the system. In our committee, everyone testified to the fact that their layer was incredibly efficient, but I don't think each layer only costs 1.5% or 2% or whatever of the whole budget. I think that there's a tremendous amount of loss, not so much in the cost of the layer's actual existence, but in the cost of the layers interacting with each other. All of the site visiting and paperwork and changes in the forms and on and on and on and on causes a tremendous amount of effort to have to be expended so that each layer's existence in relation to the other is justified. And further, there's a vertical layer, a horizontal layering that occurs of the addiction system, the mental health system, the kids' mental health system, the physical health plan, the physical health system, each of which have their own vertical layer stacked on top of them. We've got to find a simpler way to bring monies from the taxpayer to the community. And that's not really my area of expertise, but just after 15 years in health administration, I can tell you, there has to be a better way to do this, because all of these layers, each of them is oriented towards improving accountability, but they actually decrease accountability because there's this circle of, well, why do you do that? Well, because they make us do it. And if you ask them, it's because the feds made us do it. And if you ask the bucket book people, why do they do it? It's because it's how the waiver was negotiated, and on until it all makes sense this way. But if you look at the forest and not at tree bark, it makes no sense at all in terms of, do we really have accountability? Accountability is really about getting results and saving money in the process. So that's the That's just a statement from the ground. Basically, I'm an implementer. I'm not really a policy wonk in the sense I don't spend time in the library. But what I'm always caused to do is say, we're losing money here. Can you fix it? So this is the most practical way to save money that I've come up with, and would save a lot of money. I'd like to comment on some of the suggestions that came out of the cost containment groups, if that's okay. Two of them relate directly to mental health. There's an item number 5 on the draft that I got from last week, which says fully capitated health plans, mental health organizations manage mental health drugs for all clients. Estimated savings unknown at this time. DHS is calculating potential savings. I wouldn't know what model DHS could use to calculate that, because it's really never been done properly. The only models that they'll be able to use are aggressive formulary and prior authorization models. And I don't think it's any exaggeration to say that there is so much money being spent in the psychoactive drug budgets that practically anybody could save tons of money in the short term by making it more difficult to prescribe them. In other words, I believe that there's millions and millions of dollars of prescriptions going forward in the Oregon Health Plan every day that have nothing to do with getting better. And that's because it's a pure, unbridled entitlement. You can have 3 different doctors prescribing for you simultaneously. You can shop for medications. Your friend got on X, on Lamictal, and she said she feels tons better, and so you go around and find a doctor who will prescribe Lamictal. This is not an unusual occurrence. It's an incredibly common occurrence. Many studies have shown that about 15% of psychoactive drugs are taken as they're actually prescribed. 30% are thrown away. And that would be fine if the pills cost 20 cents each the way Elavil did. It's not fine at all when they're $4 each. And that's what's going on. So I think that there's a tremendous amount of loss in the prescribing budgets that is the same as inappropriate hospitalization. That is, when we were hospitalizing people because they didn't get any outpatient service or because they didn't get crisis services or a housing voucher. We substitute medications, which are free, for the more complicated treatments that are on that model that don't already exist. In other words, I talked a lot to primary care docs who do the bulk of the prescribing of psychoactive drugs. And, they get a sort of single mother, 3 intermittently psychotic due to methamphetamine abuse, unemployed, with terrible headaches, chronic pain, in the office once again on Friday afternoon saying she lost the Vicodin prescription, and they write a Paxil prescription. And they kind of know that that's not really what the woman doesn't have a serum Paxil deficiency, and that's what's going to cause, but it's free, and so they do it, and they don't feel good about it, but they do it anyway. And that's a very common way of prescribing. So what we've been talking about in some of the other groups is the co-location of this model with the prescribers that involves the integration of physical care and mental health care. Basically, I'm going to get to the point where I'm going to believe that the role of the community mental health center as a building, as a freestanding structure, needs to shrink a lot. And that those community mental health workers, and remember, I'm a big fan of community mental health programs, but I'm not a big fan of community mental health real estate. That is the location where the patient has to go to get whatever the mental health care is. We need to move our community mental health programs into places where people are inappropriately prescribed for. We need to move psychiatrists in as the specialized consultants that they're trained to be, as opposed to writing prescriptions all day long in 10-minute med checks. And that's what a lot of psychiatry has become. If you're going to see somebody for a brief period of time and renew their medication, you don't need to have specialized training. And that So everything is pointing towards the need to integrate physical health and mental health care. I had a very interesting conversation last night with Dr. Bruce Goldberg and Tom Frank, who is the business policy whiz of the Care Oregon / Multnomah County Health Department, on how we might approach that project in our area, because regardless of what happens here, we feel that it's an inevitability, and you've got to realize what's inevitable and expedite it. So I'm a big fan of bringing the 7 and 11 drug categories into management, but I'm completely opposed to formulary and prior authorization methods that are rigid for managing these medications. I think there are much more sophisticated ways to manage Schedule 7-11 drugs, which are mainly the antidepressants, antipsychotics, benzos, and so on. And it isn't about calling a 1-800 number and having somebody say, well, did you use generic Prozac? Because if the physician cares to actually talk to that person, very few of them will say, gosh, I never thought of that. That is to say, if they have, then we've done a terrible job in terms of disseminating information that Prozac's now cheap and generic. And if they really like to use the latest, greatest drug, they're going to tell the person, yeah, I tried it. And that's just the way it is. Unless you build a sort of police force to enforce your formulary, that becomes very expensive. And there again, that's been tried. And commercial companies can save money in the short term by the same methods that I just said anyone could save money, by making access to whatever it is hard to do. So you save a whole lot of money in the short term. But for them, if someone doesn't get better, they don't have to pay. They lose their job because they didn't get better, get hospitalized, or so don't pay their co-payment, then they become one of my clients. We have to get people better. And so it's about how you get people better, and getting them better is almost always the cheapest way to do it. There are some very expensive drugs with very little yield, and I'm not opposed to formulary of any kind or prior authorization of any kind, but it can't be the kind of things that some folks are bringing forward as, well, we have to do it now. The list that the previous governor created, that class of category list when you find the cheapest drug, is a terrible idea for psychoactive medications. Just terrible. And the reason is because the way you get psychoactive drugs approved is by testing them against basically a specific set of signs and symptoms of an illness. And if it works for that and it's safe enough, you get approval, then the research stops. And the way our average client looks, they, again, don't come in and say, everything's fine, I just have this crushing depression. So most of the prescribing, and or to put it another way, when you're prescribing for diabetes, you can really measure the results. The blood sugar is it's a fact. And so you can collect all this actuarial data. We don't even hardly know how to measure the outcomes of psych treatment. I mean, there's all kinds of debate about that. You can measure improvement on the Beck depression scale, but you can over-medicate someone very easily. They will no longer complain about depression. But the idea of them going out and getting a life or staying in their housing or making their rent payment is foreclosed on.
Mr. Chair, it'd be interesting to explore your unique ideas on clinical trials. Are you suggesting that clinical trials for drugs, for psychoactive drugs, is inherently different than clinical trials for
other drugs? Yes, absolutely. Much, much different. The same way that clinical trials for orthopedic surgery or urinary tract infection treatment are fundamentally different, because the nature of mental disorders.
Well, why don't you give me the example of a clinical trial you've done and that difference, and point out how it's different from...
When Clozaril first came out, I was working as a research fellow for the University of Washington at Western State Hospital, and we were at that point I was looking into basically violence caused by mental disorders. And at the same time, we were doing a study of juvenile violence in the downtown lockup and institutional changes, and whether they would cause an increase or a decrease in the use of special programs units and lockups and things like assaults, those types of things. And the outcome measures that we had to use are very qualitative. You don't get to measure the time of bone density healing you do, for example, with orthopedic care. And there is, and not all assaults are the same. So you have to spend a tremendous amount of time working on the kind, on figuring out what it is really is worth testing. With Clozaril, for example, it's never going to be approved to decrease institutional environment violence in state hospitals. That will never come up in the FDA, and yet it's incredibly valuable and it's widely known and is used off-label to decrease people's time in seclusion and restraint for chronically hospitalized clients because it has this funny anti-violence effect.
So you're saying by the very nature of depression or anxiety or bipolar disorder or that it's not possible to do clinical research that tests
the
effectiveness at the same time that does the efficacy measures the same as effectiveness?
No, I'm saying that most of the prescribing until the science gets a lot better is going to be off-label. And I would insist and could go through I don't know how many hundreds of charts I've read from a quality management perspective in my career, hundreds and hundreds of clinical records looking at what was done and the effect that it had. And most of the prescribing is off-label. That is to say, the person is not prescribing in accordance with the way that the research was conducted when the drug was studied for FDA approval. They are basically medicating to a no-complaints endpoint. So if you come and keep complaining, you're going to end up with a handful of psychoactive medication at the end of the day. That's the nature of psychoactive drug prescribing. And further, since it's so common for people to be on 2, 4, 6, sometimes as many as 9 and 15 psychoactive medications simultaneously, and if I'm lying, I'm dying, see it all the time, there's no way a human subject review committee will approve you studying more than 2 at a time. No, they won't, because it's too dangerous. And yet we do it with kids. You see kids all the time on 3 or 4 psychoactive medications. That's not scientific. That's not. You can't impose best practices because there is no science that says what to do with those folks. And so to say, have someone at the other end of the phone line who you call up and you tell them what's going on with the person, if they just shut you down and say, no, you can't do it, I guess what I'm saying is you do a whole lot of empirical practice in public sector psychiatry, and that has to be allowed to occur because it's how we get results. And so you can't add to that basically the skill set by adding somebody who doesn't know the client and is sort of a looking into a manual that's published about the treatment of depression and saying that you should or shouldn't do something or another. So I'm a big fan of real-time consulting where you have someone who's actually been in the industry and knows what's going on and knows what to do working with primary care docs. But I'm not a fan of imposing some kind of thing that you can impose for the treatment of urinary tract infections or high blood pressure or diabetes where the science is really excellent.
Representative Cruz.
How do we get to a point where we're prescribing that many psych drugs? I mean, it seems to me we're chasing something here and not catching up. Or, I mean, why would, you know, if one doesn't work, why would you add another to it rather than looking for one that works?
Changing prescriber grail is really the holy grail of the, I mean, changing prescriber behavior is the holy grail of the managed care industry. It's really hard, especially when you get with psychiatrists, I am one, to have anybody who isn't one try to influence how they practice. And they're very, they get real specialized with regard to what drugs they like to use and try first and go to second. That's, again, a sign of how bad the science is. When I was in my psych residency, right out of medical school, where you come from being a real doctor, you know, you're actually looking at sodium levels, and if it didn't, what, you can kill somebody if the sodium level's wrong. You really know what outcomes you're trying to hit. Suddenly you're in this never-never land where you're talking to a psychoanalyst one day about somebody's pre-Oedipal complex, and then you go to talk to somebody from Mass General who's talking about serotonin receptors and GABAergic, this and that, and pretty soon, you know what I'm talking about, you realize that the science in psychiatry is embryonic. And it's not that we should all like hang up our medical degrees, and it's that it's a brand new field. And why is it so late? It's because psychoanalysts controlled it for most of the century, and psychoanalysts are religiously anti-scientific. In other words, they believe in what Freud and later guru types said about, you know, in terms of theory, never been tested. So the whole idea of applying science, and usually what happens in psychiatry, as soon as there is some science around an issue, it becomes part of neurology or general medical practice. And so we're left with the basically all the head scratchers. For example, methamphetamine causes all kinds of permanent brain damage. And no one really knows how or why or what to do about it. It's very hard to study that population, but our jails are full of post-meth brain damage, and so is the mental health system. And the problem is it's not the methamphetamine that causes the brain damage, it's all the contaminants within them. And so you get very idiosyncratic types of damage, like people who can't sleep without handfuls of sedatives that would kill an ordinary person.
I just need to put something on the record that I think your description, I mean, as a National Institute of Drug Abuse investigator, I think your description of both the research and proper psychotherapy is just idiosyncratic, because I think there, in fact, is a growing science on the treatment of methamphetamine addiction that I would hope, as a director of substance abuse treatment in this in Multnomah County, you familiarize yourself with. I think there is a science here, and I think there that your notion that it's okay to provide 15 different psychotherapy drugs to a patient is odd.
I don't think that's okay at all. I think it's
it's
an outrage. It's unbelievable, actually, that it does occur, and that's why I'm trying to answer why it occurs, is because you can't really, basically we're doing, when I say we, I don't mean I condone this. I'm saying it's occurring all the time. It's a form of experimentation. Where basically, there's tremendous pressure that comes from the nurse, the school, the families, or the patient to get them better. The only thing you have in your toolbox, since that doesn't exist, is this sort of free medication entitlement. And so we see a whole lot of, we'll add a little lithium and see what happens. But the problem is they don't subtract. They just keep adding until pretty soon you get these huge combinations that if the person were actually taking it as prescribed, they probably couldn't get out of bed.
I'm sorry. I apologize. I thought you were suggesting that because the science isn't developed adequately to provide guidelines. And I thought that's why you thought psychiatrists couldn't get together and create a proper therapeutic list under the current science.
We're not there yet. We're not even close. And so to...
On depression?
No, with single... Yeah, if somebody comes in and says, I'm depressed, or you can diagnose them with uncomplicated depression, we're very good there.
So you'd accept then a drug list for a depression?
For an uncomplicated depression,
how about pain control?
I think we're all there. Well, what you're going to move me is the point where it's sort of like this and this. Pain control has a tremendous amount of good science now associated with it. But you, if you know this field, you know that it just appeared in the last 10 years, really. Before 10 years ago, when I was in my training and got the best training, you know, at Harvard University, basically you tried imipramine.
I'm just trying to deal with your question that you can't have a drug list defined by psychiatrists to guide the treatment of psychiatric disorders based on efficacy and effectiveness because the science isn't any good on the basis of some...
You're right. It's my contention that that is not the right thing to do, that we're not there, that what you need to have is an intelligent conversation between someone who's really good in that disorder and the person who's actually going to do the ongoing prescribing, not looking into a book and seeing what to do next. That's not how... We're not ready for that yet because the science, while it is good and it is progressing, for the average emergency room doctor who sees my average client or treatment failure, it's not a question of whether you should have used mifazidone first or Prozac first. It's a question much more of that. So to do intelligent prescribing really requires that you do a biological analysis of why this person's depressed, because some people should be. And the medication won't help them. You can prescribe the best meds, the worst meds. They won't get better because if you're doing a lot of meth, you're going to be depressed. That's why you keep doing meth. And so, you know, they have to get clean and sober. So you have to find out whether they have an addiction. You can't substitute medications for homelessness. So you have to do this biological, psychological, social analysis on a person. In other words, you really have to know them before you can really think about prescribing psychoactive medications for them. And that's not a given. It's really easy to start a medication and not know somebody. It's hard to actually get to know somebody and figure out what might actually work. So part of it's science, but part of it never will be, because that's, I mean, well, we can prove that that works scientifically, making contact with somebody and getting them to want to take the medication. Or let's put it this way, not taking it is the biggest cause of bad treatment outcomes. Not choosing the wrong pill, and bad treatment outcomes are incredibly expensive.
Can I say something?
Just for a minute. Representative, sure.
Yeah, Representative Cruz, an excellent question, first off. Secondly, we've just seen a dialogue that's a typical one in medicine between the person who's out in the street treating the patient every single day and has a perspective that is correct, and a perspective from someone who has studied the problem for a long time and also is correct. And somewhere between the two of them, the truth probably lies. There are patients out there on too many drugs, and you and I both know that. And yet the frustration of trying to deal with these people is overwhelming at times, and that's why your wraparound program works so well. I believe that in time we will sort this out. When I left medical school 25 years ago, I was told that depression was caused by childhood trauma, mm-hmm. anxiety for the same reason, and that you shouldn't use drugs on people. The evidence at that point didn't show that psychotherapy ever worked. People were in psychotherapy for the rest of their lives and never changed. And as we develop drugs to start changing people's behavior and allowing them to bring themselves under control, we've seen a change. But now we don't know what to do with those drugs. We have too many choices, and we have too many patients that react in different ways, and it's very difficult to decide what to use. I think that's a real problem. And as time goes by, I believe that Representative Greenlick will be right, and you will also be right, that we'll find the best methods. We'll have protocols that work. We'll be able to treat people much more effectively than we are now. In the meantime, this is what we have. This is what we have to work with. We have to make this work with the tools we have available to us now. And that's what you're doing on the ground level, I believe.
Right, and it's my basic take-home point here is that the way to really save money is to really get people better. To have them... And one of the things about psychoactive medications, to continue on with why these... some of these formularies are terrible, is that they're all, most of them are associated with what works and not with how they make a person feel. And my experience in all these years of prescribing, the main reason that the medication doesn't work is because the person didn't like it and stopped taking it. And you can't predict what they won't like about the medication. We try. You know, we say, do you sleep too much or too little? Because if a medication like Wellbutrin is famous for keeping people up, you don't want to give it to somebody who's having problems sleeping. So we try to tailor side effects to the person's presentation. But Prozac has a very idiosyncratic set of side effects, and you can't just say, since it's a member of a class, you should always use it. Because some people can only be on Paxil. They can't be on... Zoloft or Prozac, because both of them did the same thing to them, but Paxil doesn't, and we don't know why. So you have to be able to think your way, move rapidly with short-term prescriptions and so on through these problems to really get people comfortable with their medication. And there again, it's much more a matter of knowing the person than it is than going through an algorithm.
Okay, but still back to my point, which, you know, I mean, we talked about this last session in our drug task force was, you know, one of the, for the over-prescribing that we do is how do we get to a disease management model so that we aren't having things counteracting other things, and I'm wondering if this is an avenue to get to that so that we aren't having, so that we have somebody with a psychosis on one medication that deals with their psychosis rather than medications that deal with medications. Because if you're taking 15, that's what you have. You're counteracting some with others. And so you're putting out a lot of money. You're spending this money to counteract this money. Neither one of them is getting at the actual thing you're trying to do, which is make the person feel better. And so, I mean, is this a way we get to disease management?
Yes, the disease management part is on the right side of that. So that makes the treatment real short and effective because.
So you've identified, clearly if somebody's homeless, they're not going to be joyous about life. That's what would be depressive, obviously. So basically, what you're doing on the front end is identifying the environmental factors.
The formulation of the person occurs where those two arrows are, because that's where the real intelligence has to be exercised. The expertise, the professionalism has to come in, is before the treatment starts, so you get it right the first time and do what's most likely to work the first time, as opposed to trying something that doesn't work, and then you have to go back and have a consultant and all that. And then the right-hand blue arrow is when do we have... That's the best possible thing, because if you just say, well, you had six sessions, you have depression, you're out, they may not be better at all. They'll come right back in, you lost money, et cetera. So the person at the back door of the mental health system who puts people into aftercare programs has to be well aware of what mental health care could do for a person given their prognosis with and without more treatment, so that they don't recycle back through the front door.
But how disease management programs are generally developed, and I spent 5 years managing the disease management development program at Kaiser, was you get groups of physicians together on the ground, as Representative Bates pointed out, and you bring them together with scientists and with pharmacologists and with pharmacists and with others, and you work out the models that work as best it can for the majority of patients.
Right, which would happen in the treatment section there, I'm assuming. But I'm assuming on the front end you have to identify the variables because each individual, number one, has different life experiences and different things that have brought them to a point.
Life skills. Some need some kind of training. Others need other kind of training.
Right, and even with similar life experiences, with a different genetic makeup, the reactions could be different too, I'm assuming. So.
Right, and with due respect, unlike the average Kaiser client, which I might be one. Our folks, we don't just have them work with their diabetes and their hypertension. It's much more a matter of not so much disease management, but life management in spite of the disease. And so the types of things that we teach are very basic, including the amount of distance that has to exist between you and a person who's on the street, because they might get in trouble all the time with getting too close to people. And so it's really whatever works. And sometimes in some of these places, we draw circles on the floor. And so if you know someone well enough to hug them, you can get within that circle and so on, to really teach people the most basic aspect of life skills so that they can live outside the mental health center or outside the hospital. So it's really a habilitation process. And not so much learning about schizophrenia and what to do about it.
Yeah.
Peter, give us a few minutes on your thoughts of the integration of MH and physical health. How do you see that working?
Well, that's the most exciting cost-saving thing that hasn't been... We haven't even started on... I think it's available to us, and because of the losses that are associated with maintaining functionally independent health systems that treat the same clients but don't talk to each other. And most of the fully capitated health plans have not 100% penetration rate of their population, but close to it in a biennium. That is that all the eligibles come in sooner or later for health care, whereas the mental health system has... no one has argued that it should have more than maybe 12%. And so it's really mental health system. It's really a subspecialty system associated with overall health care. And it makes doesn't make a whole lot of sense to have it to be functionally independent or even in competition with the fully capitated health
plan. Just a second, Peter. Billis,
Phyllis, in spite of your harassing emails, I'm still looking for those tickets for Ellen.
Ellen,
that's total aside.
Yeah. Sounds
Ellen's
like
got issues to deal with there.
I think she's got issues.
Yeah, Ellen, you're going to have to deal with that.
So if we were to get together, well, what we're going to do in Multnomah County, one way or another, is get together with our health department, our corrections health department, and what we call the Department of Community Justice, and the very large, fully capitated health plan, Care Oregon, and figure out how to save money by getting people better. No one argues that all of those systems are necessary. One shouldn't replace the other or be consumed by another. Same with the addiction systems. We have three addiction systems which don't have compatible software and are in competition for grants and so on, operated by the health department, Care Oregon, my division, Community Justice has its own addiction stuff. It's crazy because people, our average person wandering around has contact here, there, not necessarily at random, but in no integrated manner with those systems. So the commissioners have a commitment now to create a rationalized system of care for public health funded delivery, and that's what we're going to do one way or another, is to break down the information system barriers, the confidentiality barriers, and most importantly, the political barriers between physical health, mental health, and addiction services. And because this model doesn't have a need for a well, let's put it this way, the problem is essentially political. It's not clinical. There's not something inherently incompatible with how health department, mental health clinics, and addiction services are operated in terms of their best clinical practices. But as long as they stay in these separate silos, there's a lot of loss in terms of bad clinical outcomes and cost shifting. So the simplest thing we do is co-locate, or what we're doing with our community court system, to work this interface between jail and street through the court system, is by installing county mental health workers whose job it is to stand in the midst of these arrows and divert people appropriately. It's not true that nobody who's mentally ill belongs in jail. Some of them really need to be there. But we need to get all the people who don't, who've had their third criminal trespass because they wandered into a drug-free zone or something like that in the last month, into a wraparound service support model. Well, in the past, there would have been endless argument about who has to pay for that worker, right? And should the sheriff department pay or the health department? There's all kinds of posturing and meetings and stuff like that. But if you realize what an incredible cost it is to the mental health system to have people matrixed out of jail and put on the street with no mental health care, because we then pay for it, or the physical health system pays for it when they get hospitalized, suddenly we have this huge motivation to do something about it. That's the great thing about the Oregon Health Plan and how risk is transferred to the community level. Suddenly we have all the motivation in the world to not do the most expensive thing.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Thought occurs to me, you've got Whitey up there, you know, from, what was it, Leave It to Beaver?
Mm-hmm.
I just wonder if you had any connections with Ozzy Osbourne.
He's looking for those tickets.
You're going to get those tickets.
Yeah, I'm getting those tickets. I mean,
let me say this about drug abuse and its consequences. The science is good about how to treat drug abuse, but the problem is, once they're better and clean and sober, what it has done to their brain is sometimes permanent. And that was my point about meth, is sometimes after 6 months we'll get them off meth for a long time and they are really doing badly. Their brain doesn't come back because the amount of toxins that are in these homemade drugs. And then you're left with somebody who you really can't study, because you know, the way NIMH studies people is you have to have a disease complex, and the contaminants are so peculiar that you have to work with what you got. And so I can't, that's my comment about the Osbournes.
Well, and I would say, I would say, Mr. Chair, having watched a very brief part of his show, he is functionally brain dead and making $10 million a year. So
Any questions? Peter, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any other business come before the committee? Seeing none, we are adjourned.